You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this is the Made of Clay Report, and we are going to begin our show this morning with a with the theme song that we started this out a year ago. We did our first show on Father's Day of 2013, and it was a bunch of memories that people had about their fathers. About 12 people spoke and had music that related to their fathers and their not always positive, but always important relationship to their fathers. And today we're going to talk about, the topic is, in a world where our leaders behave like children, even infants so much of the time, how do we parent youth into adulthood? How do we be fathers? So we're going to start with Horace Silver. Our guest for this hour will be Aloja Irewele. If I'm getting that pronunciation
getting
a little
closer
bit.
Closer and closer, yeah.
And we will be talking about what we understand fatherhood to be about. And here we start with Horace Silver's Song for My Father. Horace Silver and Song for My Father, and you're listening to the Made of Clay Report, and this is our Father's Day edition, and our guest for this hour is Aloja Irewele, and my pronunciation gets worse as I go along in a more rushed way.
I usually help people out by saying just call me Aloja, because there are not many people called Aloja.
Yes, and so Aloja, you found this particular song by Horace Silver as important in your life, and why?
It was during the time of my exile, or our exile, this time my wife and I, because of some rather unfortunate political situation in Nigeria, had to return to London with our four-year-old daughter. It was a very, very difficult time because we couldn't settle there. We were on our way to the U.S., and there was just many other issues, very complicated issues. Finding solace in listening to some songs. It just came. I wasn't planning it. You never plan such things. And one of the albums that really gripped me was Horace Silver. I had known Horace, for Jody Grind. I had a friend who schooled in the U.S. and brought all of John Coltrane's recordings, a lot of jazz great, and he was hung up on Horace Silver for about a week or so, just playing his music. And I was listening to this song, and these. There's an exuberance. You can see, I mean, if you listen to that song, there is a warmth as he's playing this song for his father. And just quickly remembering that most of the African Americans who were jazz musicians at the time, it was only in their music that they could truly be free, because the rest of the community, the society, did not grant them the opportunity to be free, to be themselves.
Right.
So I saw this as, in this time of my exile, where I was constrained by many things that were out of my control, but being able to listen to these musicians who, once they're in their space, and it could just be a 3-minute, 5-minute space, they could be free. They could be totally they could be genius. They could, you know, they had the talents to enforce their, you know, whatever they mm-hmm. believed. And it just, without saying anything, I mean, you listen to that, there's no vote, there are no vocals, but you can get it. And I like the cover picture. You see the, you know, this father, you know, with his hands on his knees, wearing very relaxed, looking really dapper. And this is what Horace thinks of his father. And this is what I think of not just my father, but a mm-hmm. community mm-hmm. of fathers
right.
that raised right. me, because I did not live in just a place where only my father had the opportunity to make input into my life. There were many men. I call them a composite of fathers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I know whereof you speak a little bit. My father died when I was 7, almost 8. And the men of his father's generation, not his father,
okay.
but the men of his father, because his father had some issues, but his father's generation, who were born in the 1880s and 1890s and early 1900s, they were the ones in their 60s and 70s and 80s who kind of helped me grow.
That's interesting.
And they took me in to kind of, because they knew that I could get lost if somebody didn't step in.
And actually, it's interesting because my father's last opportunity to influence my life ended when I was 6. Because I went on to live with my brother. I was raised by my brother, who was in his 20s.
Sure.
So I, too, had my father's influence up to the age of 6.
Yep, interesting.
But that was not the end of fathering for me, because there were many men. We traveled from town to town, and most of them took me in, and I still remember them so clearly. There's a saying in my language that when there's an elder in the house, the she-goat is not allowed to suffer the pains of parturition tethered to a stake. I will explain that.
No, well, pains of parturition are birth.
Yes. So, other words, when there's somebody who is mature and elderly in the house, who is wise, if he sees a goat about to give birth, you don't tie the goat down. You allow it freedom.
Right.
But a child will not know. Only an adult will realize that a goat that is about to give birth needs to be given. You can't tie it to a stake. And so so most of the men that I came across, and you know, I'm so blessed to remember all of these, they basically said to me in the ways that they interacted with me, your father may not be here, but we are here.
Yeah.
And on our watch, you will grow up to be a man.
Yes.
And so that's why I say, you know, a composite of fathers. Mm-hmm. My grandfather played a very big role. My father's father had died before I was born. But my mother's father, Paul J. Muller, who was one of the greatest men that ever lived, was very instrumental. He had a different name for me, and he treated me like a king.
Mm-hmm.
He made me the king of a town, figuratively. Right, so he would always call me the king of this, the king of that.
Yes, yes.
And that's how he treated me. So so he watched out for my grandfather. Ojemolo was not really, every time I went to visit him, he was listening out for my performance in school. I was in a Catholic boarding school. He wasn't so much impressed by my grades. Mm-hmm. But he watched out for character. So one day I returned home, and he took my two hands, and he would bless it, blow on it, he breathed on my hands, and he said, Ojewolo, which is the king of this. And so I heard that you found a large sum of money, and you did not think of using it for yourself, but you turned it over to the authorities. And he was so happy. He said, I can see the fruit of wisdom in you. That made, that's what all he was watching out to mm-hmm, hear mm-hmm, if mm-hmm. I was developing with certain values that, as I watched him and his generation, that was how they graded other men. They graded their contemporaries by the wisdom each had. Of course, yes, the large farm, the way they kept their household, but a man that was not wise was at the bottom. He was full, you know, not just foolishness, but not being wise was counted a very low. It's hard to talk about the abomination.
No, and I guess because I grew up in a culture where wisdom mattered as much as technical knowledge, mm-hmm. and people can be technically very savvy, but not have good complex moral judgment. And some people are just loose. They're careless. Mm-hmm. And the people who are careless are at the bottom because they hurt others and they don't take responsibility for what they do. And other people who may be not truly wise, but they accept responsibility and they step up to the plate. So this kind of had a pecking order of and those who are wise know that sometimes we do things that are painful, that are hurtful, but we do them in a context where we know that we have to undo the damage because we don't see any way through without going through pain first.
And just going through, you know, you started out with, looking at the world that we live in. Because of the access we have to destructive tools that can mm-hmm. kill mm-hmm. in yep. millions, mm-hmm. The amount of money, the ability for us to travel very quickly to other places, we need more wise people now than ever before. It's not just enough to be smart, because there are many smart people.
Right.
There are many great institutions of learning. So you can pick up wisdom everywhere, but we do need people who are wise to deal with the complex issues that face us, and I don't see many.
And I want to, we will pick up that thread, but I want to go back to Horace Silver and something you said when we were planning this show. I know, and my son constantly reminds me that the jazz and the blues and the musicians of the men of the 30s and 40s and 50s, this was even before, this was their freedom moment. This was when they could sing and soar without the constraints of racism or whatever in their lives. But what we were talking about as I was driving him back from school was freedom, which is for a moment, is not freedom.
It is not.
And when you crash back so hard out of that, then it oftentimes fosters really self-destructive behavior, because the distance between what you experienced for a moment and what you live on a daily basis is so painful.
And it is. And you know what is even more painful to me is to hear a lot of pundits and scholars say, why are there no black fathers? And I'm asking, are you kidding me? The system, we Africans did not come here by choice.
Right.
They did not want a visa. They didn't come back through Ellis Island. They were not looking for a new world. They were brought here against their will. And there was a calculated system to make sure that there was not a father in the house.
Yes.
And so I'm always wondering why all of a sudden people have said, why this was what it was designed to be.
Yes.
But let's go back to the jazz era. So these men and women, they're in this space, which I say like a 5-minute, or maybe the recording space, or the performance, phase.
Or the evening.
Where the only time, that's when they can be free, because here they have their instrument. And you hear them say it a lot. You can hear a guitarist say, come here, guitar. And he wants to now express what's in his mind. Or Louis Armstrong takes a trumpet, and he goes free. Because even within that space, he may not be able to buy coffee from the from that very club where he is performing.
Right.
He may not be able to sleep in the hotel where they're performing.
Yes.
And he may not be afforded the comfort that other musicians were given. So this was their space, and what they did within this small space is nothing short of a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
We can talk about Charlie Parker, who was bedeviled by so much, but listen to Embraceable You, and you're wondering, how could this man with all his demons come out with something so beautiful, so clear?
Yeah.
So that is it is a miracle. And when I look at, I've worked with a number of young men in this community, and I don't excuse them at all for not taking some of the responsibilities they should. But I look back and I say, they have never had the kind of experience I've had. They've never been in a community where more than one person fathered you. I mean, there was never a problem of if my father was in the farm, it did not excuse me. There were other men who stepped in. So we'll continue to work on that, and actually hoping at some point I will invite you to a program where we are going to reenact a rite of passage for some of our African-American kids from boyhood to manhood.
Yes, yes. And those are the kinds of things we need to honor. I also wanted to say that when somebody knows their demons and they know their angels, and they can live in the presence of both without shame, that is a darn far step towards wisdom.
Yes.
And the thing about Horace Silver that you were saying was he managed to bypass the drugs. He managed somehow to have rooted in his center self a practice of yoga and a diet that kept him healthy.
Yes, that was I read that about him, and which is why his music is wholesome. You know, you listen to some musicians, and even with their brilliance, there is a note of sadness or of unfulfilled potential. You can hear that,
right.
And because their pain is very hard to disguise pain, you cannot. Right. I mean, you can. But the musicians that had a more holistic lifestyle, it also showed in their music. So their joy was not tainted, and even when they expressed sorrow, it was healthy. It was clean sorrow. So same thing with with Horace Silver when he's. Because he, in that same album is Lonely Women, and that tune is hauntingly sad, but it's clean.
Yes, yes. And when we are free, our joy is clean, our pain is clean, and we do not have to have mixed emotions or mixed motives because we can be genuine and out there, and we need to live in such a world.
And then we don't have to hurt other people while we're trying to navigate. When we are joyful, we don't hurt anyone. We don't hurt ourselves. Yes. We don't hurt other people. When we are sad, we don't drag other people into, a destruct. So you can now have a settled base in which to deal with your sorrow, with your downfall, and to begin to rebuild. But then you are not dragging other people.
Right. And what can we take this now to? With world leaders, especially Western leaders, who've had the best educations and the best formal preparation, but they're acting in your terms, children or infants, terms which I agree with. What is that infantile behavior? What are they doing that they ought not be doing?
When I was a child, if I wanted to play with a toy and I didn't have my way, another person was playing with it, my thing would be to destroy it. So neither the child,
nobody got it.
No, I will have. Let's just go back to some stuff that have happened in this country. Let's talk about the debt crisis, debt ceiling. That's like children, infants. Say if I don't get my way, we are going to destroy this. I was horrified just to watch, and I don't care what parties they belong to or they did not belong to.
Right.
It was the talk. It was the way they were talking. And I said, oh my goodness. I lived this when I was a 3-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, my adult says, snap out of it. What you play with it for 5 minutes, then you take it for five. And we had it. Children, our attention span is short. After playing for something for 5-10 minutes, what happens? You are bored.
Right.
You give it up. But so we're talking about what is going on in Nigeria, mm-hmm. what is going on in Iraq, what is going on in Uganda. Mm-hmm. How does a man say, if my political party does not win, then this country, we're going to destroy it, any particular entity.
Right.
Why? Where didn't you take an oath saying you were going to uphold, that you were going to subject your own personal goals, we are going to subject to the greater goal of the entity that we all call our nation?
And that you would serve every person.
Is that not what we said? We signed it, basically. So how come it gets to this point, all of a sudden we forget that? And you are paid for it in any case. So you get paid for it. Why is it that we cannot have a civil discussion? We're talking about healthcare and people are carrying guns to a town hall. Over what? Why can't we come up with something and say, this is a better deal? We disagree with this, we disagree with this, but this is a good, this is a better plan. Or in terms of dealing with, let's just talk about trade.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about trade and the whole system of debt. How do we come to World Bank and say the nations that are poor, we're going to lend to them at a higher interest?
Mm-hmm.
You already say they can't pay. Why? How does that seem wise?
Right, right.
It's not wise. And why does it suddenly become surprising to us that if other people are very, very poor, they get to a point where they have nothing to lose.
Right.
And they are you know, they can destroy anybody. So why is it that we don't have leaders? I've been listening to leaders talk. Most of them sometimes talk a good game, but you see it's for a short-term gain. I haven't seen them. I've not heard many politicians or leaders say, here is where I stand and I'm ready to lose. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is what I truly and firmly believe. If my backers and those who support me do not think, then I'm willing to step down. Not stepping down from the scandal, right. But it's just right. The right. Let's just talk about. Let's come back to poverty issue, which I've always been very interested in. Are we saying that in this country we don't have enough knowledge of economics, of right. distribution? Right. To eliminate childhood poverty. I'm not talking about poverty in Somalia. I'm talking about poverty in the USA.
Are
we saying we have no way with all Harvard University, Princeton, Yale, Duke, all of the researches they've done on Cornell. Economics, yeah. Cornell, yeah. here, yeah. I see all of them, yeah. these professors, all of our leaders who are well-trained, all of the infrastructures we have, that we don't have a way of ensuring that no child is really hungry? Okay. Are we saying that? With all our great medical institutions and research, know that we cannot make health affordable for our citizens? Right. Is that possible?
We do not know each other. If you know how another person lives and what they live for, you can enter their life in ways to make it easier for them. If we do not know each other, we will not be able to help each other in any way that matters. And this is what your question really begs us, because as a culture, we don't know each other across differences. We don't recognize others. What I want, between the two of us, we came up with 8 or 9 things that people ought to be doing as parents. But I want to play a song. I want you to play a song that you brought, Wade in the Water, and tell me why it is our leaders and why we ourselves have to wade in the water, because we are, and I'm going to use loaded language, we are enslaved to materialism and we are enslaved to knowledge. And both materialism and knowledge get in the way of relationships with other people who are not like us.
Yeah. So we can play many of the songs. Let me play the one by, the Blind Boys. Let's play
that. Sure,
okay.
Sure.
Yeah. Here it goes. Yeah.
Children, wait in the water.
My Lord, my
God, gonna trouble the water.
Was the Blind Boys from Alabama?
Yes.
And Wade in the Water.
Yep.
Now tell me about that song.
The So back to 1996, when I was in London and in exile, I was looking, I just ran into this Smithsonian recording of Weird in the Water, which was actually about four volumes, and it was a collection of what we call Negro spirituals, and most of them touched me. There was, you know, Stand By Me, Weird in the Water, God Specializes. I started to understand that nobody has ever really lived life that wasn't thrust into a crucible, that was did not have to come to a point where, well, you have to step into the water first and, you know, expect the miracle to come from God. And at that point, actually, I had no other choice because I couldn't go back. I could only go forward. Mm-hmm. We could only go forward. But as time went on, as I listened to these songs of defiance in the face of overwhelming odds, the odds that just faced some people, they were just overwhelming. But then they were able to come up with something deep within, that in their faith in God, which is, when every time I say that, I really truly mean that it is impossible. I don't see a way of going through life just depending on myself, depending on my abilities, because there's somebody who was previous. I did not plan this life. Actually, I did not even plan where I was going to be born. I could not.
Mm-hmm. It happened.
So, so let's go back to leaders. Can somebody lead without really having faith? People say, do they have to be? A leader has to have a sense that I'm not in this alone. After all, we are superintending over God's children. We didn't create them. So I think it is not enough for a leader to just be smart, but a leader must be somebody with some deep convictions and faith.
And knowledge that they do not control.
Yeah, and you do not control, and then you become humble, and then you become one who seeks consensus and cooperation, collaboration.
Right. I one of the recommendations I've had for politics is that you should not be allowed to run for office unless you can state clearly and openly where you have been wrong and how your wrong-headed actions have misled people and harmed them and what you have done as a result to try to rectify the situation. If you are that mature, that you've lived that much and you can say that honestly and the people you hurt can verify it, you're ready to lead.
Well, in our present world, nobody's going to run.
But I mean, if we do not get an idea out there that challenges people to get honest about live with mistakes more than we live with success.
Yeah, and I agree with that because David said to his son Solomon, and Solomon was regarded as one, you know, the great, you know, wise man of his time, and we still quote him today. But before David died, David called him and said, "My son, whoever must be a leader must have the fear of God and rule with justice." And, you know, justice also sometimes is translated as righteousness, but it is being able to have the balance where the scale is even. Where you can encourage those who really want to do good. There is an environment for them to seek what is just and what is fair.
Right.
And then, discourage those who, on account of not having grown, have not outlived their self-centeredness, they are not the ones that you put in positions of power.
Right.
But coming back to knowing our limitations, being able to think of those we have hurt. Today, there will be many fathers reconciling with their children, which is a good thing.
Yeah.
It's always a good thing when, you know, a father, actually in the New Testament, what is said of fathers is that fathers should not provoke their children, should not aggravate their children.
Right.
So
authoritarianism is off.
It is off. And also insensitivity. There is nothing that prescribes this attitude for men, which is that they are never wrong. They can never admit weakness. What is weakness? Right. To say that I'm wrong is something of strength, is tremendous strength.
Yeah, yeah.
To be able to say I was wrong, That was not right. I didn't say that right. I don't know where that has ever that. What kind of weakness is that? What is strong? What is strength in stupidity? When you are wrong and you insist that you are right and you are going to continue to do it, that's stupidity.
And it's raw power.
It is,
and that's what we're seeing in this world is a throwing around of raw power, whether it's the left or the Tea Party or whatever, or the attempt to get your hands on power, and. We fell apart as a country as we wanted power more than righteousness, which by your use of that term is both justice and mercy.
Yeah, and it is the greatest, in now thinking about my grandfather, who was a very gentle person. In fact, his hands were so soft and leathery that I could not believe that he was once the wrestling champion of the entire, you know, region.
Uh-huh.
And that he was such a farmer. He had cocoa plantation. I never could understand why his hands were so soft.
And he could be so rough and violent in the wrestling.
Yeah, and he was so, he wasn't a tall person. Mm-hmm. He was, you know, just a wiry kind of fellow, but just soft.
Mm-hmm.
Just soft, and he looked innocent. He looked incapable of harming anybody, and yet he has sons who were like giants and he could take any of them down. So same thing when I come back, because I have to confess to you that I had always admired strength,
mm-hmm,
and ability to conquer.
Mm-hmm.
And I would love people like Michael Jordan, people who can come into a game and really just pulverize everybody, until I came down with rheumatoid arthritis. Then I started to understand the meaning of weakness, the blessings of weakness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep.
Because after all, we are taken from the earth, you know, from dust. I mean, our physical body, and you know, that we're breathing by the Almighty. If you were to ask me, what has helped me to be a father? Let me give you an answer.
Sure.
It's because my children have a good mother.
Mm-hmm.
That is the reason why I've even found it. I've had the encouragement to begin to seek to be a good father, because
mm-hmm,
my children have a very good mother, and that sets the tone. And the same thing, see, my mother and my grandmother and my aunt, they were the foundation,
mm-hmm,
for my flourishing.
Mm-hmm.
My father was a guiding hand,
mm-hmm,
but the soil, you know, the nourishing that, mm-hmm, allowed me to, you know, come out of that dry ground came from the women folk,
mm-hmm,
in my culture. And so in the Igbo community, they say mother is supreme.
Mm-hmm.
It's a partnership. There's no doubt about, mm-hmm, that. But if my children, and they know, you know, I call them and I tell them every, you know, they know certain rules. And I share with them also a vision of mine. Every birthday of mine, I read one same passage to others. I said, this is all I can really give you in life.
Mm-hmm.
I know we're going to help you through education and others, but this is the family's heirloom. It is the prayer of Hannah.
Okay.
In First Samuel chapter 2,
yes,
where,
yes,
he talks about, is the Lord who raises the poor from the dust,
mm-hmm,
you know, to set him among princes, the princes of his people, that, you know, it rebuked the proud, the arrogant, and the strong. And he said, it is God who raises up one. And I shared with them, I said, this is the source. When you talk about your family, mm-hmm, heirloom, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
And my goal has been to be very honest with my children in terms of where the ground of our direction in life is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
So, but you know, I've only been a parent for 20-something years, so
right.
I couldn't say I have, you know, I have a great, you know, experience in that regard. But it's a learning process.
Yes, yes. And what I'm going to do, kind of to take a musical break, is I'm going to play kind of in homage to the women.
Yes.
We're going to play Grandma's Hands, and that's Bill Withers' tune. And just let me get it up here.
Grandma's hands clapped in church on Sunday morning. Grandma's hands played a tambourine so well. Grandma's hand used to issue out a warning. She'd say, Billy, don't you run so fast. Might fall on a piece of glass. Might be snakes there in that grass. Grandma's hand. Grandma's hand. The local unwed mother, grandma's hand used to ache sometimes and swell. Grandma's hand used to lift her face and tell her, she'd say, baby, grandma, understand that you really love that man. Put yourself in Jesus' hands, grandma's hand. To hand me a piece of candy, grandma's hand picked me up each time I fell. Grandma's hand, boy, they really came in a handy. She'd say, Matty, don't you whip that boy. What you wanna spank him for? He didn't drop no apple core, but I don't have grandma anymore. If I get to heaven, I'll look for grandma.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and that was Grandma's Hands. And our guest on this Sunday and this hour of the Made of Clay Report is Aloja Aiwewele. And we're talking about fatherhood, and we're talking about the influences that make up a good father. And one of the things in my family, that it wasn't so much the women who were the stronger ones, although that's common in rural farm families. It's often the women who form the core and the center and the emotional and intellectual core. In my family, it was more my father and my mother's father, because when my mother's mother died, when my mother was 12, he kept the three children together intact as a family, raised them, brought in a little extra help, but during you know, on the weekends he did all the cooking and the housekeeping. Even this was back in the 1920s and 30s, men having a nurturing role was a really important part. And also my older siblings, because I'm 18 years younger than my oldest sibling. I'm there in their 70s now, and I'm in my 50s. And when they were growing up, they knew that if they needed to be in some sense disciplined, or they needed to work something out, that my father had the wisdom and the righteousness, both the justice and the mercy, in greater balance than my mother, who was more reactive. And so they took away from him. But he had a hard time. They raised seven very independent-minded children, and this was their intention, was that we all be strong bodies and strong minds and strong hearts. But when you have that kind of power in a two-bedroom house, it's a lot. It's a lot, and there were issues of whether or not my older brother would really be able to mature into adulthood in the presence of such a powerful and community respected father. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, my dad died when my older brother was 15, so he never really got to work through that with my dad as a living presence. But these other men, as we talked about, stepped in my life, and Jason was already off on his own direction, and they showed me by turns gentleness and compassion, and they also showed me some folly. People who were more into sports than they were into taking care of their farms, and they sometimes kind of didn't get things done when they needed to. But all of those are lessons for young minds to kind of grab onto and to learn.
Yeah, it's my older brother, John, who I spoke to, I spoke with him yesterday. My brother raised me up. It was my brother, John, who taught me how to clean myself, who taught me how to dress, who taught me how to bathe, and who, taught me how to cook. Right. I didn't grow up with my parents after the age of six. Yeah, brother, John, took me, and we went from town to town. And he still considers me his first son, which we've been trying to stir him towards his kids. Now he has a doctor, he has kids who have graduated, but he has not been able to get past the fact that he raised me as a son, which, but he taught, he showed me how to clean. He showed me how to, you know, wash. And my brother was very gentle. Sometimes I wish he was a little bit more, you know, troublesome. But I have my brother Michael who made up for that. So it's where he, in the villages that we and the towns that we went to, where he was teaching, he was a teacher then, he actually taught me in elementary school. The women in the community realized, and they used to say, oh, look at Elijah, he doesn't have a mother here. So they allowed him to be that father figure, but they congregated around me. And really, you know, it was like, you know, they were like, you know, they were like hawks. They would not let anything come, you know, in my way that would bring harm. And it try to make up for the absence of my mother, which actually turned out to my advantage. So, but yeah, so I do realize the fact that there have been a lot of men who have stepped up, and I have seen them in this community. Also, I've seen men who have raised their children, because they had no choice, and they are the ones who got up, took the kids to school, picked them up from school, you know, took them to after school programs, came for the PTA, or you know, when they had to meet with their teachers. So I have met a number of men here who are raising their kids, and they are, you know, performing the mother and father roles. And I want to give a shout out to those men, so they don't think they are overlooked. You know what they do. Yeah, it's not overlooked. I want to encourage them. Actually, yesterday I ran into a friend, Koro, and I, you know, if he's hearing today, I just want to shout out to him, who had you know, a tragedy in his family, losing his 5-year-old daughter, and I'm just hoping that, you know, by God's grace, he can, you know, heal from this. And but he told me his father was coming to pick him up at the airport yesterday, traveled with his mother. So there are many individuals like that in this community who they themselves are trying to find a foothold so they can be the men they are supposed to be and provide some guidance for their children.
Right, right. And one of the things I want to identify two ways to frame what I see as the major problem in fatherhood here, and one strategy or one way of thinking. It's not really a strategy, it's just a way of framing the issue. Our biggest problem, I think, in the U.S. is twofold. We focused on the nuclear family and the biological parents at the expense of the wider community. Yeah. In no culture in history has the nuclear family, two parents and their children, ever been the basis of society.
Never.
It's always been the clan, the community or the clan.
Of course.
And the other piece is what I would call competitive parenting, where we don't have really good definitions or even we don't have ways of working out how to share, collaborate in this culture. Okay. We tend to be competitive. And so when that comes to parenting and our gender roles are now ambiguous because we don't want to be locked in a box because of gender, we don't necessarily know how to share and how to work it out. So parents will compete trying to be the more or the better or the whatever and not really see that as a team sport. Put those two observations together, and each child, and I would say each adult and each senior, needs 30 to 70 people in their lives. Yeah. And those people will be there, some of them every day, some of them once a week, some of them once a month, some of them on the phone once a year. You know, but 30 to 70 people is how many you need to have the redundancy so that when somebody dies or drops out or isn't available, tied up with their own stuff, they can take over.
That's true.
And we need to think that we are fathers, mothers, children, brothers and sisters of 30 to 70 people, and start looking at the world that way, and we will see a lot more opportunities and we will see change. But as long as we're isolated without accountability or responsibility to each other, then we're not going to see any change.
We won't. That's interesting, because some years ago, maybe two years ago, I would say we were at a church gathering, and but we were coming together to talk about our children, and I said something to the group, and I was actually shocked that some of them, a few people, were saying, "Well, I'm not going to, that, you know, kind of took issues with it. But what I said to them was, I'm looking at all of you here, and I really expect you, if you saw my child doing something wrong, to
step in.
Yeah, if I don't need to tell you that. I say you have my permission. Yeah. Do I really need to be asking you that? Because if I saw your child where they shouldn't be, mm-hmm. I wouldn't wait for, I won't take it and I say, do you know such and such a child I saw? No, I would step in. Are you not the son or the daughter of this person? What are you doing here? Mm-hmm. And later on, we can talk to the parents. And you talked about competitive parenting. I think in an individualistic, this forced individualism that we've all taken as a sacred mode of living. As long as my child is doing okay, then if another child is struggling, so be it. I see that attitude.
Yeah, that's the other side with the outside
because,
children.
Yeah,
yes.
Because we want our kids to be the MVP. We want them to be the number one in the draft. But what about the child who comes as the 20th or the child who is never drafted? All of those things. So for our children to succeed, they have to climb over somebody, and we have to, you know, do everything we can to make sure they are always ahead. And you say, ahead of what?
Right.
Ahead of what? Can we spend the same energy in helping our children to be able to cooperate, to be able to link hands with the others, to be able to see the strength in a community? But we are paying a heavy price for it, mm-hmm. and it will be a fool who does not realize that in the age that we live in now, I have to have my own personal psychiatrist, I have to have my own personal trainer, I have to have my own dietitian, I have to have my own, and it's very expensive. So we are gradually dying as fools.
Right.
In the Igbo land, this is how they put it. They say, one should not wash one's hands with saliva when you are by the bank of a river. But it looks as if that's what we're doing. In the midst of the wealth of knowledge, of material blessings, mm-hmm. individuals are struggling like nothing that we've ever seen
before.
Because we would not join hands. Because we would not do it together.
Right.
I don't know if there's any crisis that would push us towards that, because I would have said, I mean, don't you think we're in a big mess already? I mean, could it get worse than this?
Yes, it can get worse than this. And where we're headed in just a minute is to talk about a situation where it's gotten worse than this.
Yeah.
But I want to walk through some wisdom that you were sharing with me and that we were honing together. And it came down to 9 observations, and they're not in any particular order except the way they flowed out. One is, these are what are the qualities we want our children to have?
Yes.
The first one that you said was acknowledge the other.
Yes.
And whether it's your father, say good morning, say hello, use a name, look them in the eye.
Affirm them. Their humanity.
Their humanity. And I would broaden that if you're on the street. In Ithaca, we do not know how to greet each other. So people don't know whether to look, whether to say hello, it depends on where you come from, what you do. But we could possibly think about, what do we do here to greet each other, to make sure that we are recognized and valued in public spaces?
And how difficult would good morning be? How difficult can good afternoon be? Have a good day today, my friend. Mm-hmm. How difficult can that be?
Now, the second thing that came out was when you go away from where you came from, or when you go away to work, or when you leave your home, what do you bring back at the end of the day or at the end of your journey? What do you bring back to share with people from where you've come from? And we need to think of ourselves, each one having a role as an emissary,
yes.
both going out to the other and bringing back. We stay alive and we change.
We do.
And we help our friends change.
We do. We do.
You said, I want them to be able to share the deeper things.
Yes.
And this is where we started a little while ago, being able to talk about the pain and the faith and the thing, the trust you have to have when it's bigger than you are.
Yes, because if we cannot encourage our children to always operate on the superficial, mm-hmm. because every one of them they want something that is meaningful. So we might as well encourage them. It's not every time that you are awesome, you just love. Well, let's strip those and really use the meaning the way they are. But let you know, I think we can. So I can say it better than the way you framed it. To talk on the deeper things.
You said it to begin with. I just took notes. Okay. Now, and it's acknowledging the other isn't to be in polite society. It's to prepare for sharing the deeper things. Yeah. And the fourth thing you said was confront, greet, embrace what does not look like you.
Yes.
And do be fearless that in the face of difference, so that if it's an injustice or if it's a wonder, let it be known. Be honest about it. Fifth thing that you said was set aside yourself long enough that you can hear what the other is saying.
Yes.
Quiet your mind, quiet your heart, still your body, so that your presence does not intimidate or in any way undermine listening to and taking in what they say.
That's true. That's true.
Apologize to our children. You said that earlier. We need, as particularly as men, but we've gone, in a certain sense, male macho culture, while on some levels there is a lot of this around sexual behavior, there's not a lot of this around other behaviors, because men don't know how to be firm but also apologetic.
If you are right as a human being, you will be wrong at some point.
Yes. Yes. Forgive was number seven.
That's, without that, none of us can. You can't even walk with God. You cannot walk with God. You cannot walk with your fellow human beings.
Right, right, right. And if you cannot forgive them, then you will never let them be near you.
And you will not be forgiven. Yeah, that's Jesus said it. That he said, if you do not forgive men, neither will your heavenly Father forgive you.
Right, 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 right. And you will get in return what you have or have not given. One of the things that I've talked about and we talked about was how to be awkward in intimate relationships. How to accept that unease that comes when you don't know quite who you are in the workplace or at school and you want to be more, or when you are involved with a person in an emotional, loving relationship, and how to navigate the sexuality, the sensuality, the intellect, and the emotion that accompanies it all.
My mother was socially awkward, so I grew up under that. But she just took herself. This is who I am. She didn't say it that way, but you know, we tried to correct ourselves. And she just said,
"It taught you acceptance in an interesting way."
I am socially awkward in many situations, but I know within me I'm not trying to project an obnoxious, position. But it's just there are areas where I'm awkward because I'm not used to. I've never been there. Mm-hmm. So I just don't have the tools. But I always say to myself, but if you show me the way, I can learn.
Yes.
I can learn.
Right, right. And if we can be in this relationship in a way that we never have to be ashamed of each other, then we can have a long-term and lasting relationship, whether we're sexual partners or married spouses or whatever, because we have respected the awkwardness.
One of the things that you ever see when somebody passes away and a loved one draws a sheet across their face to cover their death mask, which, you know, death mask is always ugly. Death is always ugly. That is the way human beings should cover each other's shame. Mm-hmm. We should put something on it. Mm-hmm. We should cover it. We should put it away. We should, like Noah's children did, the good one, not the one. It should, you know, go back and cover it. You know, we should try to. It's not, I don't mean trying to hide somebody's crime, but I mean when somebody's.
Guilt and shame are different.
Yeah, they're different. Yeah. When somebody's not too good side in terms of that's not their best showing is exposed, let's find a way to gracefully
cover it and honor them,
and then let them grow until they are strong. But you know, we wanted to talk about some other issues.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
And aim not to succeed, but to deal with our failures first, and whatever successes come, we will ride them. But most of all, we're going to mess up, and we're going to mess up in some outlandish ways. And being able to deal with each other is Yeah.
Learn to be a good tree, and you will produce good fruit.
There is a worse situation than what I can imagine here, and that's what's happened in
Northern Nigeria.
And one of the things that, so what are you doing as part of your? I mean, you're trying to knit together a global awareness for these people that shows them that there are people all around the world who care intimately, even though they can't care face to face.
Yes, everybody now has become aware of the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls, which is actually the face of the horrendous activities of a group called Boko Haram, who have adopted more than 300 girls and actually came back and abducted another 30 to 50 women, and have just caused a lot of havoc in Northern Nigeria in the name of a very warped, philosophy or whatever. That couldn't be religion.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
My wife actually has been very, very, very concerned about this and said, you know, this is not time to fold one's hands, to which I agreed. And that's why we, on Tuesday the 17th, at 5 p.m., we're going to be having a solidarity march starting from the public library and going all the way to GIAC. But it is supposed to sensitize the community to the, you know, the what the victims are going through, displacement, mm-hmm. people who have been orphaned, widowed, and people who have been maimed, brutalized. And this is not just happening only in Nigeria. It's becoming reproduced. We've seen it in the Congo. We've seen it in Uganda. We've seen it in the Sudan. We've seen it in Iraq. We've seen it across. We've seen, you know, whether it's sex slaves or child, you know, molestation in every, you know, form.
And
this is something that has to be aggressively opposed. In why we help the victims, why we help to rebuild communities, mm-hmm. and why in the Nigerian situation is very important is that Nigeria is 176 million people. The level of resentment building up now can quickly give way to genocide.
Right.
And there will be no West African country that can take the exodus of people.
From
Nigeria will flood every... and it. So that is why we... we're working under this group called Shape Our Future Now,
right.
Which is a way of solidarity, humanitarian, and empowerment, and we're working with communities to be able to first recover from the immediate devastation,
mm-hmm.
rebuild, but also encourage conversation that steers away from vengeful acts.
Right.
But to confront this scourge, with all that it takes, but seeing it as a scourge, something that needs to be removed as a cancer, but then not turn on each other, in that frustration and in that these dehumanizing acts that have happened. So that it's we really feel that there is no choice, but we can't. Silence now becomes a crime for anybody to really keep quiet. And there are many things in this country that we have to respond to.
Right.
But we want to make sure, and we are grateful for the many people, the president's wife, she has been also a supporter of this Bring Back Our Girls. But Bring Back Our Girls is that face. Our Future Now. This is an organization that is helping to actually bring substance into this movement.
Right, and it's not just about sending material aid, it's not about negotiating anything, it's about meeting as people with other people and finding out where it is we can truly benefit each other by the differences that we bring to the table, and where we won't create dependency, or we won't create false aspirations or manipulations, which so much aid has done.
Now, and that is why my wife and I, we know about aid and everything, so that is why we're very, very the statement that has gone out, it has many levels. While we're comforting, trying to bring relief, but also
to those who've been victimized,
but also empowering them to actually negotiate their own future and to take hold of it. We just want to make sure that nobody ties their hands And to be able to become partner, you know, actually leading, playing a lead role in helping the communities to move forward.
Yes.
It's just we want to make sure that we remove what is making it impossible for them to move forward.
Thank you, Aloja. And this is tomorrow, Monday.
It's going to on Tuesday. Tuesday, the 17th.
Tuesday the 17th
at 5 p.m.
from
the library, and then we get to GIAC for a simple feast of bread and water as a sign of solidarity, you know, with the victims of Boko Haram and all the victims of violence.
Yes, we're going to close with My Father's Eyes. Just a brief second of it from Eric Clapton.
Thank you,
Aloja.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and this has been the Made of Clay Report.